Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Our guest on this Let's Go Eat show is a repeat guest. He's been on before. He's a guy, though, that, you know, we could probably have him on every episode of the Let's Go Eat show, and it would always be entertaining because he's a great storyteller. I think among all of his talents and all the things he does, Ken Sanders is best to me as a storyteller. He can tell stories about anybody and anything. You mention a topic, he's got a story about it, I swear to God. Ken is referred to here in Wikipedia as an American antiquarian bookseller, and he is probably most well known throughout the country, if he has notoriety in the United States outside of Utah, as a book appraiser on Antiques Roadshow. And in this episode of the Let's Go Eat Show, we talk a lot about the Antiques Roadshow and how it works and how Ken became a part of it and what he does. And as a matter of fact, there's an Antiques Roadshow coming up pretty soon, and he talks about that. Ken is also known as the character in a book. Now, this is a book about a real incident called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, and it's about a guy named John Charles Gilkey. And so we talk about that. Ken appears in that book quite extensively as the guy who helped bring or who brought John Charles Gilkey to justice. But Ken isn't really fond of how he's portrayed in the book, I found out. He said he's a character in the book and he has to accept that, but it's not the whole story. It's not the right story. And he sets the record straight here on the Let's Go Eat show. Ken Sanders, great guest. You know, if you ever meet Ken, you'll never forget him. And you might have seen him around town. He has white hair and a long white Brigham Young type beard. And looks a little homeless, frankly, on occasion, but he's not. He has a home at Ken Sanders Rare Books. And he is... and by the way, if you've never been to Ken Sanders Rare Books, go there. It's a great, great place for book lovers. We'll get into it here. I want to thank 50 West for providing us some food there. And you'll hear the new manager of 50 West, Jen, I think it is. Jen, who stops by the table and brings Ken and Dylan and I some special drinks and some really special cookies. Oh, my God, they're good. Of course, the club and cafe at 50 West, 50 West Broadway in downtown Salt Lake City. We've been doing a lot of our shows there because, well, it's convenient. My office is right upstairs. And because they have really good breakfast and lunch food. So stop in there sometime and ask for the crack cookies. Would you? All right. So, one other thing. Remember, if you like the Let's Go Eat show, please like us on iTunes and rate us there. We're available on Stitcher. We're now available in Google Play. We're available at x96.com. And, of course, we're available at theletsgoeatshow.com. I think that's covered all the bases. So, without further ado, here he is, Ken Sanders.
I have a hard time hearing Ken, and I can't see his lips because they're hidden by the microphone, so I can't read his lips.
Bill.
Ken Sanders, you are the only person I've had for a second guest.
Oh, no? Stars and Whiskers. Oh, but
no, not the only person who's been on twice. Gene has been on twice. But it's very rare that we invite a guest back to the Let's Go Eat Show. But you've been on my mind lately. I guess you were on my mind when it looked as though you were going to have to move the goddamn bookstore.
Yeah, well, we're still going to have to move the goddamn bookstore. We just got a brief reprieve.
Yeah, so...
I bought Reader's Digest. Reader's Digest. I bought a building on 3rd East to move the bookstore, too. The building, actually, it had really good bones, but it wasn't in the right neighborhood. It wasn't quite big enough, and it had a transient problem from hell. You might do the radio show from hell, but I inherited a transient problem from hell that included them sleeping on the roof of the building and cutting the swamp cooler wires. Wires. Pipes for water.
The copper tubing.
Copper tubing.
That's what they wanted was the copper tubing.
Then the remodeling of it, I don't know. That's not my world. You know, what do you mean $36,000 for an HVAC system? So it was gonna bankrupt me.
Do you still own it?
No, I sold it.
You sold it.
And I signed a lease for 3 years on the old place.
Which is, give people the exact address.
268 South, 200 East.
And how many, you've been there, how, 20?
20 years.
Why did the landlord, and shit, you paid enough rent there to own the building.
Many times over, although I'm on a lease now, and the rent did go up, but it's still way below market in Salt Lake City. And I'm thankful to have it and have, I hope, the 3 years. Although they started remodeling, they did a drill crew came in and banged the heck out of the parking lot to the north of us. And apparently there's some, not high rise, but there's a multi-level housing unit with underground parking going up in the parking lot next door to us. So
on the
to the north.
On the north.
So, not on our property, but immediately north. So I'm skittish all over again.
So why did the landlord, why did he want you to vacate? What was he going to do with it,
well,
you know?
They bought the new owners have bought the whole corner from 3rd South to my building.
Oh, somebody came in and bought the whole thing.
There's about 10 tenants that will be affected. We've all signed 3-year leases, so we're hoping we have that long before we've got to reinvent ourselves.
How many books? Do you have any idea how many books you would have had to move?
Well, in the shop, 100,000 or so. But there's, shall we say, off-site locales of... Yeah. More books, like the 80,000 volumes of poetry I bought from the late great Serendipity Books in Berkeley.
Really?
Yeah. Doesn't everyone need... It's only 800 cartons of books.
And they're just in storage?
Well, we're triaging them. We've gotten through maybe 300 cartons of the 800 cartons.
You do that a lot, huh? You look around at... Or do people... Oh, wait. Now... Ken, before we go on with the talking about books,
you bet.
Jen, the manager here at 50 West,
where she's got a special concoction for us.
Now, Jen makes these cookies, and I've had these cookies before, and I've advised her not to call them Jen's crack cookies because that could be misinterpreted. Possible that could
have implications. False advertising.
Yeah. And
come here, Jen. Come sit right here by me.
Yeah. Oh, you want to share? You want to share the mic with her, Dylan? Jen, and then you've made us a drink of some sort. What is? So, first of all, what's the drink here?
Well, so the drink is, and as you can see, it's kind of cloudy at the bottom, so you won't get the full effect until you stir it up a little bit. It's called a dirty. I should stir it up. Yeah.
It's probably why it's got a straw in it.
I think there was a song called Stir It Up, if you think back.
Stir It Up.
Stir It Up, Start It Up.
Yeah. Little Darling. It goes
stir
like that.
Stir It Up.
Yep. So it's a dirty
like a
Dr. Pepper, kinda. And it kind of resembles the old-fashioned Iron Port.
Oh, yeah.
Iron
good.
Port. How do you know Iron Port?
I'm ancient.
I grew up with Iron Port on summer vacations on Bear Lake
Delightful,
in Lake Town,
isn't
Utah.
It? Yeah. Now, does it not resemble that?
Yes.
And you've received a diet Dr. Pepper, so dirty diet Dr. Pepper.
Dirty
so it
diet.
Tastes just as genuinely nice as if you are participating in the sugar side.
Now, Jen, will you make one of these, or will your staff make one of these for anybody here at 50 West?
You better believe we will.
Now, are you afraid of, and I don't want to open up a can of worms here, but getting sued?
No.
You know about all of that, don't you?
Of course I do.
The big lawsuit, the swig, and So Delicious, and all of that
oh,
bullshit?
Oh, yeah. I'm not afraid.
Okay.
I'm not afraid.
Fearless woman.
I have
like
no
that.
Patent right. on this, and neither does anyone else. So I'm not calling it anything that it shouldn't be called. But as far as those cookies are concerned.
Yeah. Now tell us about those. Those
you've
are
asked me not to reference them as Jen's crack cookies,
and,
which I
that's
haven't.
That's two and counting.
I have not.
Good.
We could just call them Red Velvet Delights.
Which,
oh,
you know, you are a redhead. We could
I
call
am.
You a Red Velvet Delight
or we
as
could
well.
Call him Jenna Fire. Yes, you've got that. No, you do have that. So, Jenna Fire Delights or...
Yeah, they are... I had one when you brought some upstairs.
I did.
A couple of weeks ago.
I did.
And I ran into you and you said, have one. And I did. And by God, they're delicious.
Thank you.
So,
they are a true hit down here. And we're pleasure... It's a pleasure to bring them onto the menu, and it's just, it's fun to see. I think that the art of cooking and the most joy that I find in cooking is watching people enjoy it. So,
so it's 50 West Broadway. It's right here in the ground floor of the Broadway Media Empire. And thank you for bringing these by.
You're welcome. Enjoy, you guys.
Thank you.
Jen. Right next door. To American Towers, practically,
yeah.
Which in the old days was the birthplace of one Neil Cassady, one of the more famous people of the Beat Generation. It was a rooming boarding house that Neil Sr. and his wife stayed in for 2-3 years back in the day. And Neil Sr. was a barber over on State Street, I believe.
I had no idea Neil Cassady was born in Salt Lake City.
Just next door to us, pal.
I'll be damned.
Forgive me for being
young. Tell Dylan who Neil Cassady is.
Well, let me go back even
more. Or was. Yeah.
Or,
you do know who Dylan. You do know who Dylan is, don't you?
Yeah. No. Bob, my middle.
Well, we have three different names for the drink, don't we, at least?
Well, what she called, I don't know. It's a doctor. It's a dirty Dr. Pepper. Okay.
Right, but it was supposed to taste like
Iron Port soda.
Oh,
Iron Port soda.
What was in? I remember having Iron Port, and it was never one of my favorites because it wasn't.
It wasn't root beer. It wasn't cream, and it wasn't cola.
What was it?
I don't know. This. It's this.
Yeah, look up. Just look up. When you get a second, look it up, Dylan, in the Iron Port. Now, let's. Would you? You would know better how to do it. School Dylan as to who Neil Cassady was.
Okay.
On the road with Jack Kerouac.
Yeah, but Burroughs, Ginsberg, and Kerouac are kind of the unholy three of the Beat Generation, the three possibly most famous names. Mm-hmm. But the Beat Generation was a lot more than just those three. And Neil Cassady, he only ever published one book during his lifetime, which was the first third. I guess he never got around to the second and the third third.
That's what it's called, the first third?
The first third.
Huh.
And he was really the muse and the heart and soul of the Beat Generation. He really stimulated the creative juices in all of the others, not just the big three.
What was it about him that how did he do that? Did he just buy them drugs, or did he?
Well, I'm sure that was part of the exuberance. But
what?
And he was also a skilled car thief.
Yeah. And he traveled on the road with Jack Kerouac.
Oh yes,
right?
He did. Yeah, he was the famous Dean Moriarty of On the Road.
What was it about the guy? Do you think? Do you know?
Well, I never met him. He was just, I think, one of these charismatic, catalytic sort of people that just inspire things. Yeah. And it really, he lived the life and inspired the others rather than wrote about it.
Yeah. Who of the Beat Generation of those old guys did you ever meet and hang with a lot?
I've met a few of them. David Meltzer, Michael McClure, Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Kenneth Patchen, probably?
I never met him, no. And most of those guys, they're a little older than I am. As I am, Bill.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And I just, being in Utah, they didn't come here a lot. I totally regret never having met Allen Ginsberg, for example, who did come here And he also appeared up in Boise, Idaho as well.
I met him briefly here in Salt Lake City at a concert out at the fairgrounds at the old Dirt Palace.
The Dirt Palace, of course, yeah. Yes. Which concert?
The Coliseum, is that what it was?
Yeah, the Fairgrounds Coliseum.
It was, I think it was the Young Bloods.
Oh, well, then I was, oh, yeah, no, it was Buffalo Springfield, the Young Bloods.
Yeah.
H.P. Lovecraft was the third band.
And he was there dancing
The Dance of the Vernal Equinox. I was at that concert, but I don't know if I even knew who Ginsberg was in those days.
That was
1968.
I went down on the floor with my girlfriend. I spotted him. He was dancing and twirling around, probably high as a kite on acid. And Jim McNeil, who's still around,
United Concerts,
at that time it was Jim McNeil and Five Fingers on My Hand,
the light show,
doing the light show, and I danced with Allen Ginsberg for about 5 minutes.
Well, you know, of all the Beats, I mean, if you're going to read, you should read the Beats young for the most part, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know that On the Road has a lot of resonance with 60-year-olds.
Yeah, probably not.
But I got to tell you, you know, I think that Allen Ginsberg's Howl, I think that's the most important American poem since Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass.
I would agree, and I, you know, I still read his poetry fairly often, and a lot of it is, you know, that's of course the most famous, but I mean, it's a lot of his poems are just incredibly good.
Yes.
You can judge that by how famous the first line is, right?
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness.
Yep. Allen Ginsberg.
When Alex Caldiero, our local sinosopher, who, if you've never interviewed him, you should. Alex is a trip.
We have not had Alex on the show. We should do that. He teaches down at UVU.
UVA. Yeah. UVU, Utah Valley University.
And I know I met Alex on several occasions, and then he was in the Rubber Room.
Yes. Well, he's been in all virtually every. I don't think Trent Harris makes a movie without him, practically.
Yeah, probably not.
Alex is Sicilian-born, Brooklyn-raised, Orem, Utah, sinosopher.
Yep.
He refuses to call himself a poet.
I've not really read his stuff. Is he?
You got to see him in person.
He performs, I know.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you see, he's a performance artist. There's no question. His more recent work, and I would mangle the title, Sonos of Safu or some bloody thing, is the most straight-ahead book he's ever written. But every 5 years since the 40th anniversary, so for 20 years now, he's been channeling Allen Ginsberg and Howe. And
up at the Masonic Temple.
Well, we never did it there. We've done it at the library. There's been other places. I've been involved in most of them.
Yeah, I meant to go. It was just this year.
Yeah, we did the 60th anniversary at the library this year. The 50th anniversary, however, was transcendental. More than, you know, the beautiful Salt Lake City Public Library Auditorium downtown, a block up from my store, holds about 320 people-ish. Mm-hmm. It filled. The overflow in the basement overflowed. Then the urban room, they set up giant monitors there. More than 1,000 people came to that event that night. We had poets. We had Alex. We had Hal. We had a bunch of guys doing music for us, being a 1950s jazz band. And it was just something magical that night. The people just flowed everywhere. And at the end of the evening, after Alex's performance, even the people in the overflow seating that had been watching the whole thing on a monitor, not live, stood up and gave him a standing ovation to a monitor.
Yeah, he's remarkable. How do you... You know, you are familiar with almost all of the kind of the offbeat, the underground, the unusual people of Salt Lake.
Well, I used to be, maybe. Not sure I've kept up.
And maybe you are one of them yourself.
Excuse me.
I mean that in the best possible way. And you, how do you... it's a scene that's really worth exploring, that people are kind of not aware of a lot of times. How would you advise somebody listening to this who said, you know, that sounds intriguing, I'd like to know more about this, and these people, they could come and hang out at your store.
Yeah, and we're not doing as many events as we used to in the past, but there's always really interesting people, whether local or coming through town, that just show up in the store. Back in January, on Edward Abbey's birthday on January 29th, Tim DeChristopher, former Utah fame and
former guest on this show.
Yes.
Two episodes with Tim.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, see, another double.
Yeah. I wouldn't count him with you because we did one right after the other because he wouldn't stop talking. He just said we're going to make this a two-parter, not a double.
Yeah, it was a two-parter because he didn't want to stop talking.
Well, Tim was in town for a, you know, he was before, as he was getting out of prison but not yet released, he became an employee in my store in order to avoid going back to prison for six months.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, Tim's in town. He shows up at the... I know he's coming to town, and he makes sure through my employees. Ken's going to be there this afternoon, right? So he's in town. There's this great movie. I'm going to blow the title. Something, something, something. How to learn to love. The subtitle is How to Learn to Love the Things That Climate Can't Change. The director formerly did a great documentary called Gasland.
I've seen that one. Yeah.
Well, this new one is...
I've interviewed that guy.
Yeah, well, this new one is brilliant. He and his whole team were in town. They were doing a showing at the Broadway that night. Unbeknownst to me, Tim DeChristopher gathers up all the creative people and the director of the movie, and they, Tim and Terry Tempest Williams and her husband, show up with a bottle of whiskey about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Edward Abbey's birthday. We proceeded to drink it and then go to the documentary film afterwards. And it's a brilliant, brilliant film. It's heartbreaking, but yet it gives you hope.
We'll have to look for that. We'll find the title of that. Have you looked up Iron Port yet, by the way, Dylan?
No, I thought your description was... accurate.
Well, we've got to find out what
the historical record. Yeah, we could be making it up.
Yeah,
I'll look it up. I didn't want to lose the conversation. I would have to stop paying attention to what you're doing. I'll look it up later.
You're not very good at multitasking, are you?
What?
See,
what's that?
Yeah, Ken Sanders. Ken Sanders Rare Books. We were back. We were talking about books, and you buy books.
Some people say too many.
Well, how many is too many, really? Do you? So you bought up the inventory of was it Signature Books? Did you say
no? Serendipity Books. Peter B. Howard, legendary Berkeley bookseller,
and he was going out of business.
He died.
Died, and so there, all the books are there.
Oh no, it's a tiny percentage of his inventory.
Oh.
He had millions of books. I'm a mere dilettante in the book trade. I've only been doing it for 40 years.
Do people contact you? And
oh, God, yes.
And
books find me. I don't find books. I don't have to.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And 95% of the books that people try to sell us, we don't buy because we can't sell them.
So that's what you almost always have your eye on. Well, is there a resale value in this book?
Yep.
Books are serious business.
Well, they are. They're never going to go away. I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of technological changes we go through. You know, Gutenberg and his movable type made a big, pretty big splash 500 plus years ago, and so did the internet. But the mistake people make is thinking, well, okay, yes, occasionally a book gets made into a big movie, and then it becomes popular culture. You know, To Kill a Mockingbird, Gone with the Wind, what have you.
Okay. But, I'm going to tell this story, and I don't know why I think this is so charming, but I called your bookstore to talk to you about setting up to come do this interview, and one of your employees answered the phone and said, is Ken there?
They're very protective of me.
They are. And they said, who's calling? And I said, this is Dylan. I want to interview Ken on my podcast. And she said, Ken can't come to the phone. He's looking at books right now. And I kind of thought, well, isn't Ken always looking at books? I'm never going to get a hold of him if he can't come to the phone when he's looking at books.
Good point.
Else does Ken do?
I read them occasionally, Dylan.
Isn't that looking at books?
Do you?
How else are you going to read them, Ken?
Do you
Braille?
So do you ever worry about? Well, you were starting to talk about the technology and and Kindle and iPads and all of that sort of thing. And there was this prediction. You know, people were saying, "Oh, the book is going to go away." Not going to happen, is it?
No. The point I was trying to make is, other than when we cross over into pop culture, as it were, books aren't mainstream. They've never been mainstream, and neither are bibliophiles and the people, you know, the book lovers that love the books. We're off in some far distant corner of the universe, and we're still there, and we're not going anywhere, and we'll be around another 500,000 years. It's not a problem.
Yeah, my next-door neighbor is a poet, published poet, Jacqueline Oshiro.
Of course I know her work. We carry her books at the store, of
and
course.
And she's very good. And I remember saying to her now sadly deceased husband at one time, I mean, we live right next door to each other. And he said, Jackie's off. She's on a book tour. She's just published this book, and she's, you know, out to sell the book. And I said, must be remarkable, that, you know, just a wonderful thing. She's out there and she actually sells books. He said, come on, you have any idea how many books a book of poetry sells?
I've published a number of them. I know.
They sell nothing. I mean, it's like...
copies is a big seller.
Yeah, it's a couple of thousand copies, and you're a well-known poet. That's exactly what you're talking about there. Yeah. It's a niche. Poetry's even a...
Well, I've published a number of poetry volumes now.
Your own...
Dream Garden Press is a publisher I started in 1980. Don't send me solicitations. There's no... staff, there's no place where it exists, there's no marketing, there's pretty much nothing. But I occasionally publish a book of poetry. I did Alex Caldiero's Poetry is Wanted Here. I did Ken Brewer's last volume of poetry, the poems that he shared with his family and friends as he was dying of pancreatic cancer. It's called Whale Song, A Poet's Journey into Cancer. And it's a really powerful, powerful book. And I've done Utah Phillips' songbook. That's poetry of a different kind. Mm-hmm. Starlight on the Rails with his son, Duncan Phillips. It's a great book with tons of photos in it. And then just late last year, we released another great Utah musician, Kate McLeod's, the Kate McLeod songbook, which is a lot of fun. I got 52 of her original compositions with words and music and lyrics and all that you know, stuff I can't read, you know.
These are people that come that you know.
Oh, yeah, of course,
Is that the only thing you ever really publish?
Well, if I don't know it, it's unlikely I'm going to publish it. And I don't sell enough of any of these things to even pay for them, so not what's motivating me. These are things that I think need to have a print record, because, you know, all this digital technology and even the technology we're using right now, we don't know how long any of it's going to be around.
Yeah.
And books either, but a good solidly printed book on neutral pH or acid-free paper, unless you burn it or, you know, abuse it, it's going to be around a heck of a lot longer than we are. And words, to me, are important. Or like my favorite, Bill,
yeah.
Humpty Dumpty to Alice. You know, she kept interrupting him because she didn't understand all these words in his poem. And finally, in frustration, Humpty says to Alice, "Words mean precisely what I wish them to mean. Nothing more, nothing less."
And I think it's a, you kind of scare me, though, because you skip by that. But the historical records of things, so much of it is now just out there in the ephemera. What happens when all that breaks down, as it could do?
Seems likely it will.
Yeah, somebody, I mean.
You and I were at dinner the other night. We were having a family dinner. And we were talking about a stack of floppy disks that you have that we just, the technology to read your old journals and whatever records are on those floppy disks no longer exists. But like you're saying.
I could probably find somebody who had, and I mean by floppy disks, I mean the ones that were really floppy.
I remember.
I have a bunch of those that has old, they have old radio comedy sketches on them. It's nothing that, who gives a shit, I guess.
Or but something people do give a shit about. Like, there are Charlie Chaplin films that are lost forever. There are pictures that they took on the moon that were on film that they just didn't take care of that are gone. That
film is particularly the
old...
The old acetate film that would spontaneously combust.
Yeah. Just technology...
I remember you telling a story on the last time we talked about, you were interested in books and collecting things, because not only books, you collect stuff, a lot of different kinds of things.
Yes, Bill, I am a collector.
Yeah.
It's a curse.
So you just had an interest in that as a very young child, even, right?
I was an omnivorous reader from the beginning, and by the time I got out of grade school, I had read every book in the school library, not literally, but everyone that held any interest to me. And beyond that, one of my defining moments with libraries was at Woodrow Wilson Elementary, when we had marched down as a class down to the South Salt Lake Library on State Street and check out books. And I got all the books I wanted, Dracula, Frankenstein, took them up to the lady there, and she took them away from me and said, "These are from the adult section. You're not allowed to check them out." Well, that was quite an epiphany for me.
How did you get around that?
I don't recall specifically, but I found ways to get my hands on copies.
So when did you become aware, other than just being a reader, that there was something even more to this? I don't know quite what I'm trying to ask. That there's a more of a magic to it than you just like to read.
I was a kid in the 1950s, and back then, outer space was huge, especially in the 50s, and it wasn't militarized like it was during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Maybe not as much now. Mm-hmm. And the idea of these Winston juvenile sci-fi and Robert Heinlein and all the Isaac Asimov and all the great sci-fi writers of the day, most of them wrote young adult sci-fi on the side. So like, Escape from Venus, and Marooned on Mars and all these vanished civilizations. And oh my God, the vampire cows on Venus. Oh my God, those are terrifying, man.
The vampire cows.
But it released the imagination, especially fantasy fiction. But everything, like I remember one from a Scholastic Book Service, and anybody my age would remember, the 25-cent books once a month, the weekly reader.
Yeah.
Seaview Secret, and it was about some New England house on the coast. And to me, born on the shores of the Great Salt Lake, this was like, that was practically as exotic as Mars and Venus, or the missing rings of Saturn. This giant, the ocean, and this old... It was
And so you could go
a two-story house or a three-story house. That was beyond my childish comprehension. What? Stairs that go upstairs? We only have a basement.
What did your dad do for a living?
Well, Dad worked for half his life is in my uncle's window shade shop, Sanders Window Shades, on South Salt Lake State Street. Then one day he just kind of opened his mouth and at a bankruptcy auction and bought a trophy shop, Bowling Supply.
I remember
and
you telling me that.
That started Price Drake Trophy and Supply.
Yeah.
My dear late father, he was an enthusiast. He had a revolving sign that twirled around on State Street that says, "Stan, the trophy man, says, you can't beat our deal, even if you steal." That was my dad. He was a Utah Stars booster, huge sports nut. He had basketball teams going back to before I was born. His basketball team, first it was, I think it was Sanders Tropical Fish.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18-plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Then it became Sanders Window Shade and then Price Drake. In the glory, he had every college athlete from the schools in Utah playing pickup games in the summer for him.
Really?
And they still, to my knowledge, hold the all-time basketball record of any basketball team anywhere. Now, this is amateur.
Uh-huh.
They won 121 straight games.
Jeez. And now, did he coach them?
Yeah. Dad was maybe 5'8", and he didn't have any athletic prowess whatsoever.
And did you?
No.
Were you a disappointment
I'm
to
a
him?
Lot of
Because you didn't like sports as much.
No, right? No, I've never been a sports guy.
And was that kind of disappointing to your dad? Or was he fine? You know, that well.
Probably.
Ken does his own thing.
I had to be the ball boy for the basketball team when I was a kid. And I can remember when they were going to have to forfeit games, he would force me to play the slow pitch games with him. But I hated that.
Yeah.
14 years old and being forced to play baseball with adults.
Yeah. What did you think?
I wasn't that much fonder of the trophy business either, for that matter.
What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I had no clue. I thought I knew two things when I was 17 years old and graduating high school. Ooh. Is one, high school to me was unpleasant. It was a prison. I hated it. And I think, you know, I graduated maybe with a D-minus average. I wasn't disruptive. I just
didn't like it.
I sat in the back and read books of my choosing.
Yeah.
And so I didn't. I made the decision, well, why, after getting out of 3 years of prison, i.e. high school, why would I voluntarily sign up for four more years of prison at the college? Why would I do that? And the other thing that was kind of big back there in 1970 was, you know, the little draft lottery for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I submit to you, watching, and this was weeks before, a month before my December birthday, President Richard Nixon, live on television with a giant metal cage full of ping pong balls with birthdays on it. And he picked... One of the earliest numbers he picked out was my birthday. But this was like a month before. I was 17 years, 11 months old, so I wasn't 18 yet.
Yeah.
But it had a profound effect on my life. And, you know, despite my father being, like most of our parents, a World War II veteran, along with going to college, I was determined, I'm not going to Vietnam.
Well, like Muhammad Ali, you didn't have a quarrel with them Viet Cong.
No. I knew it wouldn't be a path for me. I considered being a conscientious objector, but I don't really believe in any kind of formal God, so that seemed kind of hypocritical to do.
Mm-hmm.
I debated, you know, migrating to Mexico or Canada, but again, I, in my naivete at 17, I chose a pile of books to take to prison with me, including Civil Disobedience by Thoreau, of course.
So what did you do?
Waited till I turned 18 and got a high draft number. But I would submit to you.
Yeah.
President Nixon on TV. That's the world's first reality TV show. Name an earlier one.
Yeah, good. I mean,
if that's not reality TV, and that was real reality TV before they faked it up.
Yeah, no, I mean, they were picking the number that you could get killed. Yeah,
pretty much that's what you do by then.
Yeah. So you're 18. You're still in town, hanging around. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with your life?
Well, a high school kid and I, Dave Fagioli, we're going to open up a book and record store together called Ticonderoga, after a lost colony on the East Coast, like Roanoke.
Oh, yeah.
And Dave actually bought a house, but then he found out on 9th South, but it wasn't zoned for retail. So we kind of went our ways. And Dave, actually not too long after that, at 9th and 9th, opened up Round Records and Bound Books with Kurt Setzer, kind of a jazz musician.
Uh-huh.
The two of them used to play in a band called the Nameless Uncarved Block that later became, in the early 70s, could be, I don't know about, certainly Utah's first punk band. I'll leave it at that. There is no God, only noise, the Atheists.
That was the entire name of the band?
Well, the Atheists.
The Atheists.
But that was their logo. There is no God, only noise, the Atheists.
I like it. So there you are. No, I'm not going to open a bookstore with Dave. What do you do?
I spent a summer in Southern California working at Collector's Bookshop on Hollywood Boulevard.
You like that?
I love the store. The reality of a sheltered Salt Lake teenager being exposed to Hollywood and Sunset Boulevard in the, late 60s, 1970, that was a bit of a cultural shock, I must say. So by the fall, I turned tail and came home.
How'd you get that job? Just went down there?
Yeah, just walked in there and asked.
So you said, I'm going down, I'm going to go to California, see what's there.
Yeah, I had a great plan.
Yeah. I'll just go to California, see what's there.
I was a teenager,
Yeah, well, no, it's great.
And I worked off and on for the late Sam Wellers, as I like to tell a story, Sam, because he was the real bookman in town in my youth. Sam hired me 5 times and fired me 10 times. But there were 2 other. There was Gene Wilson and Wilson's Bookshop on East 2nd South. That was a great, great store. Later turned into something called the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Then there was old Johann Becker. I always thought he was German, but apparently he was Dutch. He and his wife had an antique bookstore that was always kind of around Sears and 8th or 9th South, and one old condemned building after another. He always had little, beaded curtains that separated the living quarters from the shop.
Oh, yeah.
And he was very, very tolerant of this teenage boy that was really into books. And he would spend Saturdays hours with me, talking books with me.
Yeah. And so you worked at those places?
No, only at Weller's.
Only at Weller's.
And, my first book job technically was Central Book Exchange in Sugar House, a paperback trade place that's still there, still hanging on out there.
Oh, is it really?
11th almost to 21st.
Huh.
And I was 14.
Oh, there was when I was, when I lived in Ogden many years ago, there was the Bookateria.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that did that. I used to go in there fairly often. So you work at Sam Weller's, which was a great, it was a great bookstore.
Oh, yeah. No, Sam was a good bookman.
He knew what he was doing, I remember the first time I ever went into Sam Weller's bookstore, probably in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, sometime. You were probably working there, or maybe you had been fired, I don't know.
Terry Tempest Williams claims that that's where we met, was at Sam Weller's, and she was still a teenager.
But I always thought I would like to work in a place like this. That would be a great thing to do. I'd like to work in this bookstore. It was just terrific. And you'd go down in the basement, and all of those old books and magazines and everything, and then all the contemporary stuff that you wanted upstairs, and whoever did that kept up with it well. I thought,
I think you'd be great in a bookstore. You'd like to talk with people about the plots of books and
maybe I should do that.
I'll do this install so you can have some of your talk was there, Ken.
Yeah.
Perfect. You'd be great to argue with people about characters and plot points of books and debate about the meanings. But as soon as your boss told you, you know, you need to alphabetize, I don't see you carrying a stack of books and, I don't know. You're not one to alphabetize.
Well, of course I
see you. I'm not saying you can't. I'm not saying you're not a hard worker. I'm not saying you can't alphabetize. I just don't see you as somebody who would alphabetize.
Well, I may not have a great deal of enthusiasm for it, but
right.
I would do it.
You want me to do what?
Yeah. Okay.
Like, you know, just why don't you go, let's take you over to Ken's place for a while. Just let's say 15 minutes, have Ken put you to work alphabetizing some books. I just don't
catalog
see it.
Catalog these for me, Bill.
I just don't see it happening. It's just not your temperament.
Well, it might not be.
It's just the one thing there I don't... I mean, I can see you even, like, cleaning up the bathrooms more than alphabetizing books.
Did you ever have an interest in library science? Did you ever want to do that? No, never.
That grade school librarian kind of put me off of librarians.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
plus,
Bill.
Yeah.
Libraries have, especially special collections, have really, really cool stuff, but they won't let you buy it.
And you like that. You like the commerce.
Oh, any book person, it's the acquisition of the thing. It's the hunt.
It's like it's the reason people, wine people are like that, too.
Wanting to see something you've never seen before.
Do you have
never
a great,
held before.
Do you have a great white whale or two that you would really just love to get your hands on? Or?
Well, yeah, but for me it's more... Yeah, sure. Everybody like, you know, you want a Gutenberg, you want a Audubon, you want a Shakespeare's Folios. But those are all pretty known things,
yeah.
You know. I want something unknown. I want some great illustrated book I've never heard of
before. So you stumble across those occasionally. Well, give us some for instances.
Well, there was some years ago I was volunteering. In fact, there's a brand new book out by Rebecca Rego Berry, and now I'm not going to remember the name of the book. She's the editor of Fine and Rare Books magazine, and she's got a new book that has some 52 book collector tales of great discoveries of books. It's really, really a fun read, and she chose one of the stories I told her to be in the book.
Oh, please.
And it's about the I was out. It was a blizzardy, snowy April. And I had volunteered to do...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Appraisals for the Sandy Historical Museum. I didn't even know there was a Sandy Historical Museum. I never heard of it. So me and some antique people went out there and were the appraisers for the day. It gets pretty dead. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, this guy comes in. It's this big black garbage sack and says, I got something real valuable here. And he proceeds to, I roll my eyes because, you know, people have said this to me before. I got a first edition. No, you don't.
Yeah.
I can almost just say that verbatim, and I would be right 99 times out of 100. So he unrolls these big, massive pages. They're loose. It's a broken book. They're not in order. They got all these weird old woodcuts, and I'm sitting there. It took me the longest time playing with them and looking at it. And finally, it dawned on me what the heck, because it doesn't have a title page, nothing like that. This is... you're going to have to give me a second.
Have another bite of taco. Maybe that'll help you.
You edit these things, right, Dylan?
Actually, no, we don't.
Yeah. Oh, God.
No. Just like he doesn't alphabetize, I don't edit. I like talking. I like recording.
Chip,
I like hitting
Chip
record
didn't
and
fall
mixing
far
levels.
From the tree.
No.
I don't edit.
So you look through all of this stuff.
So, finally... I got to finish my taco.
Black garbage bag. You say there are woodcuts in it? I mean actual wood blocks in the bag?
Okay. So it's a big folio, pages.
Hmm.
turns out it's a Nuremberg Chronicle, which is one of the most famous books in the world, maybe not as famous as the Gutenberg Bible, but printed about 20 years later, printed in 1492, and it's basically a history of the world up to that point illustrated. And it's one of the most well-documented books printed prior to 1501 are called incunables or incubalia, and it simply means the cradle of printing.
Okay.
So this guy, and it's like, what? This guy just brought in a 500-plus-year-old book. So I say to the museum director, you know, if you wanted any publicity for your museum, I'd get on the phone to the media right now. Well, Fox News is the only one that came. I got yelled at my pals at Channel 5 and 2 later. Why didn't you call us? I said, you know, she did. You guys blew her off. Yeah. Fox was the only one that would come. So that got me a call from somebody I know at the AP, and they said, by then it was, this thing had gone viral. And they said, look, because we were going to quickly put the press release and announce we're going to have somebody from the special collections that you come down, do a whole exhibit, bring some pages, because it was just crazy.
Blew up in the book world.
So she says, hold off, let us break it on Monday, and then do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. We did. So the AP wire service went out early that Monday morning. This was like 2 weekends before we killed Osama bin Laden. If it had happened that weekend, nothing, right?
Yeah.
It literally went viral. Me holding this 500-year-old book, picture me in a story, appeared in the front covers of 300-plus magazines around the world. It was just the weirdest phenomenon. I got... people sent me copies in languages. I don't even know what the languages are. Cyrillic alphabets, Persian alphabets, Arabic alphabets, you name it.
What's the backstory? Where did this guy get this?
He had a wealthy uncle 50 years ago. He inherited all this stuff from back east, and he's kept it under his bed for 40 years.
Didn't really know what he had.
He said, the weather was too bad to, you know, go out fishing or whatever, so he decided he'd bring it in.
I mean, he'd looked at it before and thought, well, this is probably worth keeping.
Yeah, but he didn't throw it away. Oh my gosh, the attention we got for that thing, it literally went around the world.
So what is something like that worth monetarily, and what did it do to this guy?
He didn't want to talk to the media at all. He made me do all of that.
Mm-hmm.
He was a real funny guy. He didn't... originally, I didn't have permission to sell it. As it turns out, the book was maybe 60% complete. And clearly, a long time ago, somebody had gutted it. Mm. The good stuff was gone. The money plates, the giant... double truck fold map of the ancient world that was be worth thousands and thousands of dollars all by itself. All the really valuable, it's a parts book is what's left. Mm-hmm. Somebody probably 100, 200 years ago parted it out.
And sold it.
Sold it piece by piece.
For good money at the time.
At the time, yeah. So what was left was probably worth $25,000, $30,000. I could have sold it 10 times over, but I didn't have permission to. By the time... he gave me permission to sell it. Nobody was interested anymore. It had come and gone. Huh. And whole, especially a hand-colored version, which this one wasn't, would sell for six figures.
So what happened to it? Did he take it back home?
As far as I know,
put it back under
the bed.
Good Lord, that's so bizarre.
If this had come into my bookstore, I don't think it would have, you know, it's just some guy in a bookstore. But something about the snowy Saturday, the museum nobody's heard of, somehow it just had this elements for like an O. Henry story or something, you know?
Yeah.
You want to buy it?
Well, sure I did. I wanted to sell it and make a commission
off
it.
But I didn't
have permission to when everybody was in furor over it. Yeah. Oh, and the best one ever, I got a phone call. But I've learned how to handle these phone calls. This guy from the Midwest calls me. He says, I saw that book on TV. It's mine. It was stolen from me when I was a child. So what I kept saying to this guy, and he'd get more and more ridiculous, really? That's incredible. And I meant it. I meant it, Bill.
Yeah.
It was an incredible. I said, you know what you got to do? I've got photos. You've got to document this story. You've got to get it written down. Send me an email, snail mail. Mm-hmm. You send me all the photographs. You write out that whole story. Get back to me on it. Because if I'd blown him off and started making fun of him, he'd still be harassing me to this day.
Yeah.
But by, really? That's incredible. And I meant every word.
That's the way you get rid of him.
And I never heard from him again, of course.
You want to have another bite of taco?
Sure.
And do you still do the Antiques Roadshow from time to time?
The Antiques Roadshow's coming back to Salt Lake City.
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
August 13th, this summer. It will mark 10 years. I started with them 10 years ago in Salt Lake City. It was kind of a walk-on, and I guess they like what I do. I must know something about something other than just a Mormon book, because they wouldn't keep having me back if it was just Mormon books.
Is that why they originally contacted you? Was it for exactly? Do you remember?
Well, Sam Farrell, one of the producers, called me up and asked me. He said, "Look, I've been looking around for someone to do Mormon material when we come to Salt Lake, and every single person I call gives me your name." So that's how it started.
Yeah. You got that reputation probably from the Mark Kaufman case.
I had nothing to do with that, really.
No?
I only ever met Mark Kaufman once in the Cosmic Airplane days in the 1970s. It was a hippie head shop that I turned into a bookstore.
Yeah, it was a great place.
It was. It was a legendary place. Mm-hmm. At the height of it, we had 30 employees.
Really? That many?
Mm-hmm.
My God, it was a moneymaker too, I would guess.
Yeah, it was, but you know, we weren't really very good businessmen. And when a business grows too fast, it can be as deadly as no growth.
No,
because it just the cash flow becomes nightmarish, and we lived that. In fact, I just shredded some. I found some old tax returns that were from the Cosmic Airplane days. My gross salary for the year was $12,500.
Jeez. Cosmic Airplane, for people who don't, did it start as a record store?
No.
Or a bookstore?
No.
Or a head shop?
Jones and Sherm Clow started it in 9th and 9th in the spring of 1967 as a head shop.
Yeah. Sold pipes and beads and incense and
imported
cigarette papers.
Imported from San Francisco was the ad. Imported.
Yeah.
Steve had quickly four locations, 9th and 9th, South Temple, which would be the steps leading up to the Delta Center today, and then briefly the one no one knows on West Temple, almost to 4th South. And then when Steve Jones, the original founder, Bruce Roberts, an old radical from here who's deceased, and myself got involved in the mid-70s, we found and remodeled the First South.
That's the one I remember the best.
That's the one next door to the Blue Mouse Theater.
Yeah.
And then later, a year or two later, KRCL Radio started broadcasting from upstairs.
Upstairs, yeah.
Scott Carrier, Trent Harris, and a host of other people had offices up there, too.
Yeah. What was Steve Holbrook?
Holbrook, yeah. Well, he was the founder of the KRCL.
Yeah.
With Robert Redford's help, because the Outlaw Trail by Cowboy Bob came out in 1977 or 1978. He signed 500 copies for us, and we raised $5,000 for Holbrook and KRCL before there was a KRCL.
I remember that location very well, and it was a great shop. Still had the hippie cigarette papers and all of that stuff and pipes and stuff in the front. Books everywhere, records everywhere. And wasn't there a little performance space there as well?
No. South Temple there was. Maybe. Smoke and Rocks and Gravel Blues Band performed there and practiced there. The Human Ensemble Theater got their start in the old Cosmic back room.
Maybe I remember. I must have gone there too then.
But we didn't have the luxury of that kind of space on First South.
So go back to Mark Kaufman. I had been under the impression that you'd helped something with that case, but you just met him once. Now, Mark Hoffman was the forger who forged all kinds of Mormon documents and that sort of thing.
More non-Mormon than Mormon.
What do you just stuff?
He did his story. He did everything from Emily Dickinson to Abraham Lincoln to Herman Melville to Betsy Ross.
Now, how did it come about that you met him? What was
he came into the Cosmic Airplane in the late 70s trying to peddle me stuff. Nobody knew who. And all of a sudden, like every week, there's some news story about this incredible find by this whiz kid. And it's like, wait a minute. Every week, this guy is finding something that would be a find of a career. And he's doing it weekly, and nobody got wise.
Did you look at the stuff that he brought in?
He and I were oil and water, and I sent him packing. And in the 80s, after I sold out, he came back in there and defrauded them to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. But on my watch, and I can't really take the credit for it. There was just something, maybe he just thought, you know, this guy, he ain't LDS. I'm not going to be able to pull the wool over. It's going to be too hard. I don't know. I'm making it's revisionist history.
Yeah.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
But we did not get along.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I know, the bombs are going off and he's murdering people.
Yeah. He'd for those who don't remember the story or know the story, he had claimed to come into the possession of some important historical documents having to do with the Mormon Church, and he had sold some of them. To Mr. Sheets,
well,
was he?
He had taken six figures from at least three different entities
and then
for
this,
a partial payment for a mythical collection of damaging documents to the Mormon Church that didn't exist,
And
partly of the McClellan collection.
And I think this guy Sheets, as I recall, was on to him.
Gary Sheets.
Knew that it was on to him, and he said it was gonna blow the lid off of it. And Hoffman put a bomb outside of his office door, and he opened the door and it blew him up and killed him. And then Hoffman, a day or two later, or the same day, I don't remember.
No, it wasn't the same day.
A while later, because nobody knew who had done this or why.
Right. The headlines were Salt Lake was like downtown Beirut.
Yeah.
This was in 1985.
And then a few days later, a bomb goes off on, was it Main Street or State Street?
In the judge building.
Oh, it was in the judge?
Yes.
Was that, no, where he was in his car? There, another bomb?
No, there were three bombs.
Okay, so what was the other bomb?
Mrs. Sheets was the first victim.
Okay.
And then, for crying out loud.
I don't remember another victim.
It was a relative of Max Christensen, Mr. Mac.
Uh-huh. Did it kill him?
Yes.
So
he picked it up outside his office in the judge building and blew him to...
Killed two people.
Then the third bomb, who
was
they still speculate, he was over by the Desert Gym,
right,
got out of his car and blew himself up. We don't quite know
whether
who
it was
third
a,
volume was.
Whether the, well, there was speculation that it was he did it kind of on purpose. He thought maybe he was going to...
I don't think so. I think it he just mishandled it. I'm certain it was... Most people believe it was for the LDS collector in Provo, Brent Ashworth.
Right. But that's how he got caught. He blew himself up.
Right. Well, at first, everyone was rushing to his defense, that he was a victim.
Yeah. And anyway, he ended up... He didn't die, and he's still in prison.
With a mangled left arm, he could never revive his forging career.
He could never
the last I knew, he was... roommates, cellmates with Ron Lafferty.
Oh, what a good pair.
The Lafferty
brothers. That's a wonderful pair.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about, I want to ask you about, I want to talk about the book, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much. But one other quick question about Antiques Roadshow.
Sure.
You've made many appearances on it again. You'll be on it in August.
Well, there are no guarantees. I mean, it's not scripted. It's completely live. They give away 5,000 tickets, typically to any city. The demand can be, I haven't heard Salt Lake, the demand can be anywhere from 20,000 to 30,000 people, even though you're not supposed to. People sell them on eBay.
Yeah.
They're free tickets.
Yeah.
They do give the sponsoring station, KUED, 200 tickets to sell as a fundraiser for the station. So there's 5,000, there may be 10,000 items that are going to come through that day and or collections.
So you will be there.
Yeah,
there'll
be
books.
There's 70 appraisers approximately in 24 categories that they appraise in. Mm. And we are on the set at 7-ish in the morning, and we don't leave at night until the last person has gotten their appraisal.
It's a lot of work.
I've stayed as late as 8, 9 o'clock at night, just working straight through.
And then what? You only get on the show if, wow, this is a... Do you call people over and say, hey, come here, I got something. You call the camera guys over, the producer?
There's protocols. They're only going to film maybe 50, 60 segments. They do three separate shows out of one day. So if you see something you want to pitch, then you grab a volunteer and they go get a producer. Early in the morning, it's a quick process, but boy, as the day wears on, you're sitting around waiting forever for producers. It's a real problem. It just takes too long.
Yeah.
And you got to keep the guest on ice, and you don't want them talking about their stuff. You want it fresh for the camera, for crying out loud.
Save it for the camera. Save it for the camera.
No, we can't talk about this. You want to get enough information out of them. There's kind of at least two questions you ask them. Do you own the item? Because if they don't own it, it will not be filmed. Mm. Number two.
If they say, no, I brought it in for
my sister and
neighbor,
I,
or my dad.
All the owners have to be there. That's number one. Then, do you want to be on TV? Because some people don't. There's no use going through the whole process if they won't refuse to go on TV.
Why
are they there? Yes, I know.
Well, it's like when I went to The Price is Right, they ask people, do you want to be on camera? Do you want to play the game? Why would you go to The Price is Right?
Because you like the show and you want to see it.
Stupid.
But people are there, they want to get there. They want to get their stuff appraised.
You go to an appraiser.
It's a free appraisal.
It makes me angry. I'm upset. I'm not even there.
That's why. It's a free appraisal.
Stupid.
And so we see a lot of people. By the mid-afternoon, things can... You know, people's tempers are wearing down. And I just, you know, I try to see, you know, they're here for Antique Roadshow because they love it.
I think it's a very entertaining show.
Even though they have a completely, I don't ever use the word worthless at the show.
Mm-hmm.
I try to find something nice to say about their worthless item.
Yeah. You know what?
But I don't ever use that word.
Even the people who get on camera, they're item is worth something. Occasionally, though, no, I think, don't they show occasionally, they'll show, you know, really, this is a wonderful family heirloom, however. They do show that occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
However, enjoy it in your family.
Right.
Because that's all it's good
however,
for.
It's a reproduction made 50
but
years
ago. Yeah, but if you love it, then you should love
mm-hmm.
it. That's fascinating. They give you an appraisal price. You know what amazes me about that show too, and you do it as well. The specific knowledge that these appraisers of things seem to have of things. Oh, this is a Native American basket, probably made by the Iroquois. How in the hell do these people know these things?
Well, you've got some of the best dealers and appraisers in the world doing the show.
Yeah.
God. And especially for a Luddite like me, I mean, my goal, Dylan, this year, I think I had to buy it, but I was given iPod.
Uh-huh.
It's over a year old, and I don't know how to use it.
Well, it's obsolete now.
Oh.
Oh, geez.
Because I was going to take it and try and do research. But you don't know. You just don't know how, if you even have time for it.
Yeah.
Because you're supposed to be at your table working.
Yeah.
Unless you're in the green room getting makeup or on the set filming.
So let me ask you, they give the people a price range.
You don't have to. That's up to the appraiser. There's three things you can tell them or how you appraise. If you do not include the context of the appraisal in the appraisal, the film's lost.
Oh.
You have to say at retail. You have to say at auction or for insurance purposes. You have to give a context for the value.
I see.
And it's up to you to say a specific amount or a range.
Mm-hmm. So then I've always speculated that there must be that those people, the appraisers that are there, and you being one of them can confirm this. Then they are the ones who often offer the people. They'll say after the cameras go off, do you want to sell this to
no,
me?
No. Oh,
no.
God, no. That would get you fired.
Oh, really?
It's commercial free. We're not allowed to know anything but the first names of the owners. They know who we are.
I like that.
After the anything, as long as it's not the same day, if the people want to contact you and do business, they can. They discourage it. They don't like it.
Really?
But as long as you play by the rules, they'll permit it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm allowed to put out, taped down, a single business card at the table. I am not allowed to hand you a business card. That's breaking the rules. On your way out, where you do the self-exit interviews.
Yeah, I
thought I had this great thing, and it's a piece of crap. Mm-hmm. $5.
Or, I found out this was worth $20,000.
And she breaks it in half, holding it up.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's the worst sound on the set.
Does that happen?
Crash! Oh, every time, there's a huge crash.
No.
You could have some fun with those contexts of prices.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at a yard sale,
I told you the only three you're allowed to
say.
Oh,
there are the only three.
I used to be able to say in my shop at retail. That's out.
Uh-huh. Because it's too much like your... It's interesting that they have that much integrity. It would not bother me to find out that they actually try to... Or that they actually offer the people some... If you would like to sell this to me... I'd be happy to do. That wouldn't bother me.
I can't. Yeah, I can't even suggest that.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And it doesn't, I mean, it happens less and less. Mm-hmm. People do follow up once in a blue moon, and I do get something, but it's not common.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it's their show, so I play by their rules.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that they just have that they wanted to have that integrity.
Right. Yeah, they're afraid of that. Because I don't own or watch television, Bill, but I've heard of Pawn Stars and, you know, Storage Wars, whatever.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pretty commercial weirdo shows out there now.
Yeah, and they're pretty cheesy. I find Antiques Roadshow very entertaining. I mean, I don't go out of my way to watch it, but I'll be scared. And I'll go, it's Antiques Roadshow. And I'll sit and watch it for a while.
There's a reason why for 20 years it's been the biggest show on PBS.
I think those twins are kind of weird, though.
Lee and Leslie Aquino have been nothing but kind to me.
I bet they're very nice.
I have to say.
It's just, they're just twin appraisers. And they are identical.
I can't tell them apart.
Yeah.
They're the Antique Roadshow rock stars, obviously.
Yeah, they are. They're on every show, aren't they?
If they want to be.
If they want to be.
Well, they even quit and went and did their own rival show and got their butts kicked.
I didn't know that.
Got canceled after 1 year and were allowed to come back. Do you think they'd allow any of the rest of us to come back?
No. All right, let's talk about probably the most famous thing. Is this the most fame you ever had, probably?
Well, that's hard to say.
I mean, infamy.
Infamy is a better word.
Let's talk
about... The Dark Side of the Book Trade, Bill.
It's a great book.
And you can have your own opinion about that.
You don't like it much? The Man Who Loved Books Too Much?
First of all, I call it The Man Who Loved to Steal Books Too Much. Is my title for it.
Well, that's true.
And I've probably signed 500 copies of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a book I wrote. I'm a character in her book, and so is my own personal book thief, John Charles Gilkey.
Let's talk about this. Tell people the story of John Charles Gilkey and how you got involved in that.
In the 90s, I finally got around to joining the ABAA, the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, ABAA, not ABBA, the Swedish rock group.
Are you still a member?
I am. Okay. So they wanted to vote my Southwest chapter out of existence, and I objected just on principle. So the chapter rep from New Mexico calls me up. I like to joke our Southwest chapter has more states than members. It's really the East and the West Coasts that have the population. Mm-hmm. That's where the book fairs are, etc.
Yeah.
So, I felt, well, it's hypocritical of me. So, yeah, okay, I'll do something for the chapter. Well, you can be the president or you can be the chapter rep. And I said, I'll do anything you want, except don't make me treasurer. I won't be treasurer. Don't let me near the money. So he calls me back and says, oh, Kevin McDonald in Texas is going to be the president, so you can be the chapter rep. Okay. No idea what I just agreed to do. So apparently once a year I have to fly to New York to go to a board meeting. You go to the board meeting, and, now you got to be on committees. Oh, okay. So they put me on the membership committee. Oh, there's nobody. We need security. Okay, you're security. Well, it's supposed to be a committee, and apparently I had committee members, but I don't think I ever knew who they were the 6 years I did it. And, I kind of have a obsessive personality. So when I get into something, I really get into it. So they send me this box of pink sheets from headquarters in New York. And a few months goes by, and I get a call. Have you processed the pink sheets yet? What? What are those? Well, every time there's a book theft, a member fills out, handwrites out a pink sheet, mails it into headquarters, and then once in a while, we mail them out to members. Oh. These pink sheets, they're of a theft that happened theft to you. To one of our members.
Oh, okay. So
I get a box of these, and they're like 1 to 3 years old. Like, what the heck good are these? So I dutifully went through it and did it, and that's the last time a younger member of the ABA would have any more idea of what a pink sheet is than you do. Because me, the Luddite of the group, my daughter had taught me how to give me an email address, and I knew I can sit there and peck on the computer and do email. So I started getting reports out of Northern California of people losing pretty, multiple $1,000 books to some thief. And he'd call on the phone, act knowledgeable about the books, and then give them an Amex number and charge it. And then, it's a birthday present. I need it. Can you overnight it? Just charge that to the Amex. Well, in the 90s, we were pretty green. We thought if we've never seen the card, right? But we've taken the numbers down, all the jazz.
Yeah.
And run it, get the approval. Well, we thought that was gold.
Sure, the card.
It ran.
Yeah.
No, that's a huge fallacy. Credit card fraud is staggering. And the only person who gets hurt by credit card fraud, it isn't the consumer. Consumers are well protected. And it's not the banks or the credit card companies or the processing companies. That leaves the merchants. You're stuck. You can get a charge back from 6 months to a year later. Anyhow. So, and then sometimes it's, my dad's going to be in your neighborhood tonight or in the morning. We'll just pick it up. Come in, sign for it, pick it up. Nobody's ever seen the credit card. Month, 2 months later, you get the charge back. And then he starts escalating. And clearly, one store is only going to fall for this once. So at first, I thought I was chasing a gang of people. And then now people are starting to send me internet reports, email reports. So instead of sending out pink sheets, I'm just going, the minute I get the report, I'm typing it up. We set up a security line that went out to every member of the ABAA and say, okay, warning, so-and-so books and, Bakersfield, California lost, a first edition Great Gatsby,
And these were all pretty valuable books?
Always in the thousands of dollars. Always under 10 grand, though, because credit card companies won't process a $10,000 order without speaking to the cardholder.
So, but these are, expensive volumes.
$7,500 on the road, $5,000 gone with the wind.
Jeez.
And he's ramping it up. He's escalating. Uh-huh. I say he. I don't know who he is.
At this point, you don't.
No.
But did you figured it's one guy?
I thought it was a gang.
Yeah.
And we can't go into this whole story. It's way too long. Turns out to be John Gilkey and his father, son and dad, thief combo. And they got away with it. They kept going. They ran out of Bay Area, so now they're doing it cross country. Long story short, it takes me 3 years out of my life and an enormous amount of time. And through the help of Royal Books, K. Kevin Johnson, he'd had a book stolen. He reported it, and the theft technically took place in Santa Clara County, California, which is San Jose. Mm-hmm. San Jose has a high-tech crimes unit, unlike other parts of the world. Then Ken Lopez, a good friend and bookseller of mine from Hadley, Massachusetts, he gets a phone call. A year earlier, he'd gotten a call for an expensive book. The credit card was declined, so he never thought about it. It's the same voice. And now I've been hammering him for 3 years about the book thief without a name. And he recognizes the voice. He calls me up. Your book thief called me. I'm sure it's him. Okay, go along. Don't run the card or anything. Just go along with him. Get the address where he wants. So I get on the phone to Kevin Johnson. I call San Jose cops.
Yeah.
I get Detective Kenneth Munson. Unlike any cop I've ever met, he listened to this convoluted story. Who are you again? Well, I'm this bookseller in Utah calling on behalf of a guy in Maryland that lost a $7,500 book to a crook in your jurisdiction, and we're trying to set up a sting with him through a bookseller in Hadley, Massachusetts.
Yeah, why did he
pause.
Why didn't he just hang up?
You know? Yeah. He's unlike any cop.
Yeah.
Well,
that's interesting, sir. Thanks for calling.
But it was his jurisdiction, so God knows what.
Well, you are a compelling storyteller.
Even on the phone, apparently.
Yeah. So, I mean, you must have told the story well.
And the address, because now we've Googled it, is a San Jose Hilton Airport. So they set up a sting. It's not like in the movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. They sit on their ass until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Finally, a guy goes in. Are there any packages for me? Under the real cardholder's name. Picks the... We thought it was really funny. He bought a $7,500 Grapes of Wrath by Steinbeck. Mm-hmm. So we had to send him something. Clearly, we're not going to send him the real book. So we did a first edition, facsimile edition of the Grapes of Wrath. You know, it's worth about $25.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, he never got to open the package, so he never got our little joke mm-hmm. we played on him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We got you, pal. they pick him up. I don't know what you guys are talking about. Guy in San Francisco gave me $20 to come here and pick a package up for him. So they go on the hunt for the one-armed man, so to speak.
Yeah.
Then they throw him in to jail. He's clean. He's got no wallet, no ID, no keys. The only thing on his possession is a crumpled up prepaid cell phone, burner phone receipt that proves that he called Ken Lopez. Then they turn him loose the next day and he won't tell him who he is. I about had a heart attack. Munson, no, don't worry. He's going to show up for his court date. They always do. He did. So then we learn finally, after 2 years, we learn the name of the thief, John Charles Gilkey. And then the rest of it is just, it's way too long to get in and tell, but I finished it up. Now I'm tracking him real time. Every time he goes into a store, now he needs some money for lawyers and stuff, so he's trying to sell hot Winnie the Poohs all over L.A. And they're calling me on the phone, sending me emails. We got people stringing him along and then offering him really low amounts that just enrage him and make him furious. Finally, but I dutifully report all this back to Detective Munson, including at one store, because he's using his real name because he needs a checkmate. He can't have a checkmate out to an alias. He gives him an address, and I just, it'll be a fake. I gave it to Munson. I now get a call from Munson. He's on a borrowed cell phone because they don't give the cops cell phones back then.
Yeah.
And he's inside of Gilkey's apartment in Treasure Island, of all places, in California, out in the bay.
Perfect.
Perfect name, huh?
Yeah.
And this house is full of thousands of stolen autographs, photographs, posters, and books. Ken, you got to just take it all. No. It's not the way the law works. I have a warrant for very specific items. You tell me what you can prove stolen. And every one of the 10 items I gave him, he found and he took. And all the rest of it, to this day, is somewhere rotting in a warehouse in Modesto where Gilkey's from, and nobody's ever going to get it back.
Why?
Got to prove the crime, pal.
Now, Gilkey's in prison.
Not yet.
No?
No, he's on the lam.
Oh, I didn't realize. I thought he went to jail.
Well, he's been to prison six times. They practice law enforcement as catch and release out there. As recently as a year ago, his new M.O., dad's long dead now.
Yeah.
What he did, by the way, how he got all these Amex numbers with high credit limits is every Christmas season he would get hired at Saks Fifth Avenue or some high-end department store and just steal all the high-end info because he knew they had really high limits.
Yeah.
And then January he'd go on a spree.
So he's portrayed in this book, the man who loved books too much, as a guy who did this because he just loved
bullshit.
Love the book. But what is that's how he's portrayed.
At the end of the day, he's nothing more than a common, dirty little thief that preys on people. And it's hardly just books. He's completely and utterly amoral. He has no conscience. He doesn't care what he steals from whom. He finances overseas vacations. And his current M.O., as of a year ago, and I hope I got him shut down, but I don't know that I did. He would call up and book a bed and breakfast in a resort town with a female for the weekend, 3-day weekend. Yeah, he shows up, no female. Oh, she couldn't make it. That he's booked it online and used a hot credit card. The B&Bs don't check him. The one woman that contacted me said, I've done this for 27 years. No one's ever stiffed me before. She was she was perplexed.
Yeah,
they don't think that way. So he spends the art galleries, prints, any antiques, books. Goes all over town, kiting checks on a Bank of America account that has been closed since 1991. He just keeps making checks up. Do you think they give a rat's ass about him? Nope.
Why does he keep getting away with it?
Because each theft is small potatoes. Cops have more important things to do. They don't take book theft, particularly intellectual property theft. They don't take it seriously. They don't care.
Yeah.
And even though I'm sure he stole more than $1 million by now, it's a few hundred here, a few thousand there.
This continues to vex you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I at least shut him down in one city because a jeweler almost fell for him, but Gilkey ordered like thousands of dollars of custom jewelry online. He says, I've been doing this 40 years. No one has ever bought anything from me sight unseen. You don't buy custom crafts like I do without seeing it first. Mm-hmm. So that raised some bells. Then the minute you start Googling Gilkey, you're going to find all about him and me.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as he's using his name, I thought I'd poisoned the well that nobody could be. So he's branched out from bookstores, clearly. Yeah. He'll steal anything.
You don't like your portrayal in the book.
The biggest issue, I mean, I'm a character in her book. Mm-hmm. The biggest issue I have is when she was on the trail of Gilkey herself and visiting him in prison, and then he's out of prison, she calls me up one day and says, oh, Gilkey wants to go book scouting, and I thought we'd go to a thrift store, but he wants to go to John Crichton's Brick Row bookshop, which was one of his original victims, and they stole a 3-volume first edition set of Thomas Hardy's Mayor of Casterbridge from him, worth about $8,000 or $9,000. And I said, no, Allison, you can't do that. That's absolutely bullshit. And if I thought she was going to have done that, I would have called Crichton and warned him. She and Gilkey fucking went there and blindsided him. And I can't ever forgive her. We didn't talk for a year or more after that. And in her book, she lies about it. She pretends that I originally thought it was a swell idea and a great idea and encouraged her, and then after she did it, got mad. And that's just, she lied. Yeah. It's just pure, she made it up. And so I'm like a character in her book, and I do and say whatever the hell she wants me to.
Did it for dramatic license.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who cares what the real Ken Sanders thinks about that?
So she lied, and I think she crossed a line. I think she... she makes Gilkey way too innocent. He's a pathological liar and thief. I think he's a psychopath.
Yeah. I mean,
and he will not quit stealing until he's dead or back in San Quentin.
Yeah, you know, because the way the book is written, it does romanticize.
Yes,
him.
I hope.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me say this about it. I never pretended to be Sherlock Holmes. Okay. But I absolutely guarantee you John Charles Gilkey is as far removed as Moriarty as he could be. He ain't no Moriarty.
Yeah. Not that smart.
Nope. No, he's not smart at all.
He just gets away with it because it's small potatoes.
Yeah. And he knows nothing's going to happen to him. He's not afraid of being arrested. It's like nothing will happen to him.
Yeah. It's interesting that you... I think it's fascinating that you still... You still kind of keep after it.
I have no choice. I mean, they come to me.
No.
It's, you know. It's,
you would have, I mean, it's people that call you up.
My name's forever associated with his.
I'm sorry.
Just make it clear which one of us is the book thief, okay, buddy?
Well, Ken Sanders, you're the good guy.
Oh, wow.
You are the good guy. Everybody knows that. Ken Sanders' rare books located on 2nd East between... 2nd and 3rd. Right?
268 South, 2nd East.
Yeah. Go if you've never been in there, go in there. It smells like books.
Rotting paper.
Yeah. Smells like old
people
books.
People comment on that every single day. Always everyone loves the smell.
Yeah. I mean you walk in there you go, oh, that's what a bookstore is supposed to smell like.
Yep.
You will find something to your liking there, and you'll also find stuff there. You know, Ken talked earlier in our discussion about how wonderful it is when he finds something that he didn't know. You'll find a treasure there.
And they're not all expensive.
No.
Treasures can cost only a few dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's not like it's I don't think we've given the impression that it's not a place where it's all these first editions. And
well, it's that too, Bill. I mean,
you've got that.
I love selling books to readers. There's a whole wall. We've got one of the finest literary paperback selections of any bookstore in the world. Mm-hmm. Along the back wall are some 10,000 volumes, and there's not a bad book on the shelf, and there's not a bad condition book on the shelf either.
Just go drop by, visit, say hello. Glad you came back. It was great to talk to you again. Great to have you back on the podcast. We talked for a long time, and we'll probably have to have you back for a third episode.
Yeah,
we've shut the restaurant down.
My taco's cold.
They're ready to close.
No, I'm sorry. The man has a cold taco. Well, let's let him finish his cold taco. Ken Sanders, the Let's Go Eat Show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill. Dylan.
Thanks, Dylan. Thanks to 50 West for producing the show. Not producing the show, for providing the food at the show. Dylan produced the show.
That's right. And if you're pouring the drinks, what should they do?
If you're pouring the drinks, remember, always make mine a double.
There you go.